Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 161 with the title Beyond the DEI Backlash. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Waymer Hoover. Waymer is a global diversity, equity, and inclusion expert and former chief diversity officer for Fortune 500 companies, including no less Google and Sanofi, dedicated to driving systemic change and cultural transformation. When I asked Waymer to describe her superpower, she said that it is championing sustainable DEI strategies in a shifting corporate landscape. And don't we need that right now? Hello, Waymer. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Joanne. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. And you're based in the New Jersey, did I hear you say?
I am. I'm based in Princeton, New Jersey, which is right outside New York City and situated between Philadelphia and New York.
And it's a bit nippy, a bit cold over there at the moment.
Yes, we've got a cold front. This is our typical Northeast weather that we have forgotten for many years, but came back blistering over this.
Yeah.
But it's quite nostalgic. I don't mind so much.
No, it's nice sometimes. It changes it up a bit. As you're saying in the green room, get a chance to wear some different shoes, different coats, and different outfits.
Exactly. I'm pulling out all of my heavy coat and my various different shoes that has Gore-Tex and the different materials for cold weather to keep your feet warm. So it's been a lot. It's been a long, you know, we will welcome the spring. But right now, the fireplace, the heated blankets, all of that I'm enjoying. I'm enjoying for the moment.
I'm shivering just thinking about it. Yeah, in the UK, we get frightened if it gets to 1 degree centigrade. So yeah, we're struggling here at the moment. Wait a minute, you were telling me about your name. It's a beautiful name. What's the history behind it?
Thank you. Yes, my name is Wema, which is Swahili, and it's spelled W-E-M-A, and the E is pronounced like a long A, that language. And it means true goodness. So that is, you know, the background of my name and was given to me through my parents. They were, you know, in the early 70s and here in America wanted to embrace our heritage. And so I've embraced it and I've hopefully lived up to the name through the work that I've done and how I show up in the world.
It's a truly beautiful name and an even more beautiful meaning. So thank you for sharing that. Yeah, lovely to meet you. We talked about your superpower, you know, championing sustainable DEI strategies in a shifting corporate landscape. And we first started talking about this podcast back in October, November last year. And the landscape has shifted. It's not glacially slow anymore. It's been an avalanche in the last few weeks, hasn't it? What's happened?
It has. You know, it's been quite this change under our new political administration, which has, you know, really targeted diversity, equity, inclusion programs as one as being unfair and discriminate against, you know, those that are not in the minority or marginalized community. And which I think is unfortunate about it is that it is really not understanding and taking in consideration the intent of diversity, equity, inclusion programs, which is not to provide advantage or preference, but it's to provide access and level opportunities so the best and brightest can shine. But unfortunately, that is not the narrative that is being purported, and it is actually being hijacked and really, you know, a lot of misinformation around it is prevailing. And what I am doing through my work and my consultancy is helping organizations continue to leverage inclusion, equity, tapping into the diverse experiences, perspectives, backgrounds, sexual orientation of the workforce so that it can truly, truly maximize the talent and potential that will drive their organizations forward. So I'm working with my clients, and I'm working also with organizations to ensure that the true meaning and essence and purpose of inclusion, equity, and really the value of diversity is not lost, and that it can still be leveraged not only for the employee engagement to make sure that everyone feels like they are working in a safe, welcoming environment that they feel like they belong, but also for connecting with the customers, the clients, and having impact, right? And serving, your constituency in the most culturally relevant and respectful and dignified way.
Do you think some of this backlash is because many people trying to implement the equity agenda, for want of a better way of describing it, I don't like that phrase myself, felt that they were being marginalized themselves? So the white man has found themselves being pushed out of opportunity, and that's where the backlash has come from.
Yes, Joanne, I think it's a bit of that. And also, I think there is a mindset of zero-sum gain. So that if you gain and have access, and I see more of people who are not like me, then I am automatically assuming that I'm at a loss. When in actuality, it is not a zero-sum gain. It is opening the aperture so that the true fabric of what United States and America was made on actually flourishes, right? It actually flourishes and thrives, because if you look at any point in history, and especially in the United States history, the time that United States have grown from an industrial standpoint, from a technical standpoint, from a manufacturing standpoint, is also correlates to the highest times of immigration. So that diversity was at the center of every growth, every expansion, every innovative innovative change and shift in the country. It was correlated with immigration and really being able to leverage all of the different talent experiences and skills of the people coming into our country. So the sad thing about it is that we know this. This is evident. This is in our history, in our research, but yet and still this misinformed and completely false narrative is reigning, because there is an assumption that, because we're giving the opportunities, that there is a loss for a particular community or a group of people. And my fear is that that loss is going to translate into a loss of our ability to become and maintain our competitive nature, to harness the true talent and potential. And that, we live in a global world right now. These are individual, people are able to, be employed, get opportunities outside of the U.S. or in other forms. So I say that it's even more imperative now for our society, for organizations to really anchor themselves and connect their, DEI efforts, inclusion efforts, whether it's just be shifting the names, making sure that it is really centering all people so that they can truly tap into and leverage and maximize the best skills, innovation, ideas, and perspectives of the people in society.
What's surprising me is the number of household names, big brands that are suddenly purging their own DEI initiatives on their Facebook pages on their website, not part of the federal government. Have they been waiting for an excuse to drop this, or do you think they're being leveraged by the administration to make these changes?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Joanne. And, I want to, actually address that. And although we have been seeing, a rampant amount and been publicized, the companies that are kind of de-investing or minimizing their DEI, which is a propaganda strategy as well, because it's not all of them. I mean, you look at it, I think, they did an estimate, and I think it was between 7-8% of the Fortune 500 companies. However, if you also extract that and dig a little deeper, those are the companies that have only been invested in DEI probably for the last 4 to 5 years. So they're the ones who literally, when we had the horrible murder of George Floyd in 2020, that was a pivotal point, not only in the United States, but across every market and every country, where you really looked at, you know, what is happening between the markets, not only the opportunities, but the impact that they're having in society with access to, you know, grow, to have opportunities, that everyone was reevaluating. Those are the companies who really touted and stood up their programs. And now, you know, we can truly say that perhaps that was just window dressing, right? It was a moment in time that it was socially acceptable to do something, do those. But if you really kind of dig into those that have de-invested are the ones that have not been, has not had it a part of their strategic imperatives, that has only been, you know, really focused on it after that time, right? As a response, but not as a practical approach to their workforce development, to their talent strategy, and to their market segmentation and ability to drive their business.
I remember probably 6 or 7 years ago, if not maybe more, when it was either North Carolina or North Carolina had the bathroom bill, wasn't it? They signed the bathroom bill in North Carolina, the first state to do so. There was a real solidarity behind a lot of serious brands and corporate companies opposing it, pulling their conference out of it, basically saying, we're not going to support North Carolina anymore. Is that solidarity still there? Are there people going to push back, or is the administration too powerful at the federal level now?
You know, that is a broad question, and I can't give a definitive answer. What I can say is that I think right now we are still within the first 100 days of our new administration. And I think everyone is really paralyzed because no one knows what's coming next. These changes have come so fast and furious. I think everyone is really trying to kind of make meaning of what to do, how to maintain, you know, the efforts and their intention, the ones who, you know, the companies, organizations, and the states that are truly trying to make a difference and ensuring that everyone feels safe, feels included, feels like they belong, have this environment that they can truly be their authentic self. So I do believe that right now we are in a place of just being still and waiting to see what is happening, because literally these things, you know, Joanne, is happening daily. I cannot tell you. It's almost like our head is spinning every single day with something new. And so I have been counseled, and I know a lot of the focus had been on how do we retain instead of being reactive and having an emotional and a direct response to these, all of the executive orders, the changes coming out. How do we retain what is good and what we know what works for us? How do we connect it to our value systems, connect it to how we share our shareholders? I gave you the examples. Costco. Costco's shareholder put a vote to rid of its DEI programs and not have any of them. And Costco, you know, pushed back and said, no, we are not doing that. Because that is the nature and the essence of how we engage our customer and clients. And we want them to come into the Costco and feel that it is actually connected to them. It understands them. It's actually giving them, you know, products and services and access to things that's are. And so they rejected them. And I think that that's what the position that, you know, kind of most organizations are. And I think that that's the position that most states are doing. Kind of how do we protect, right? Protect right now in this series. See, you know, we're in still in that first 100 days. What it is coming that obviously can legally be defended in this time and era. So we are still in the thick of things, you know. But I think I shared with you earlier what is keeping me encouraged, even though every day it has been an effort to get up and stay encouraged. Around, you know, the small, you know, the acts of kindness that has been so increased tremendously. Like I've experienced it and I've done that. I think there is a spirit and energy. It's like, you know, whatever's happening at the macro level, what kindness, what extension of humanity can I drive myself that really impacts the community I am in? I've felt that and seen that in tremendous ways. And that is giving me the energy and the courage to know that, you know, there is still that passive resistance through create, you know, like Mahatma Gandhi said, you know, be the change you want to create. And I've experienced.
Mm. As an observer from the other side of the pond, it seems like a dystopian reality that Margaret Atwood created in The Handmaid's Tale. Some of these things are just with the last administration 4 or 5 years ago. I believe that things like that could happen. And I'm believing it even more now that one day women's rights are going to be peeled back so far and nobody's going to be standing up and saying, no, we're dismantling too much of the protection mechanisms. Roe versus Wade, to push back, anti-abortion everywhere. Women being pulled out of influential positions in power, demonized for, was it the Coast Guard? Head of the Coast Guard was a woman, being blamed for disasters. Almost like a resetting, a rhetoric such as, if you want a job done properly, it has to be a man, has to be a white man, and women aren't able to deliver. We want more masculine energy, according to Zuckerberg, in organizations. So how far-fetched is Margaret Atwood's vision? It's sounding closer and closer now.
You know, honestly, I don't know how it is far-fetched, but, you know, what they say, you know, reality is always stranger than fiction, right? And so you have these things. But again, you know, I want to say that in any society, United States, you know, in the U.S. and even abroad, where we actually had other pundits that did not get, you know, when I was living in France, I mean, you know, Marie Le Pen was, you know, I was there during the election with Emmanuel Macron, and she's not as dissimilar to our current president. But I do think that you have factions of opposing ideologies and political stances that are always at the fringes, right? Because again, I go back to what I said earlier, there is the thought that difference equals loss. Difference equals, you know, there is, you know, a sense of change or hijacking what an entitlement that I believe that I have. You know, but I also do believe that, you know, this is a moment in time. And I think what is happening here, especially in the United States, there is a reckoning, right? Because those who may have voted for the current administration did not realize just the kind of massive, not only changes, but dismantling that would happen that would affect their own backyard, you know, from an education system, from an immigration system, you know, from an access in Social Security. So I do think that there is this almost like still reality that, wow, this is not what I signed up for. And, you know, because of that, you know, my hope, and I am encouraged that there will be more, you know, people that would stand up as we look at the midterms coming up and looking at the expectations that we have for our, you know, political leaders who represent us to actually put them in action. And that's to say, hey, you know what? We need to have people who understand not only my issues, but can actually create a society of law and order, which feels like we don't have, which we don't have anymore.
People have drawn parallels with 1930s Germany, 1920s, 1930s Germany, where the incumbent administration dismantled the protection mechanism in such a way that there was no one to stop them. And then a momentum took place. And I think if we're not careful, that this administration is now controlling the media. We realize how powerful social media is. Facebook, X is a powerful outlet that drives opinion. And it would appear that the administration has implicit control over those.
Unnecessarily. I would absolutely ascertain that the media outlets are giving a fair description of what is happening. And they are objectively challenging. I mean, even in the press rooms and even in the White House briefings, even in the news and the as they had, they have to, because these are things that are accessible to the public. You know, the executive orders, gross negligence in some instances, gross negligence and incompetence that is happening. They have. And it has been reported really accurately and on those platforms. So I can't say that there is not like this shield that we are all putting at, you know, kind of putting up on us that we're not able to understand and know what's really going on. Oh, no, it's quite the opposite. It's almost like it's too much. We get all of the reality, but it is happening so fast and so daily that you almost get overwhelmed, and it makes you have, you know, this feeling of helplessness, which, you know, maybe a tactic that you're like, it's happening so fast. What can I do? And that's where I say, you know, we talked in the green room around, you know, the need for people daily to really wake up, understand, and be very thoughtful about the information they're taking in, how they are kind of making meaning of it. And then how are they kind of orienting themselves through meditation, through prayer, through whatever, through yoga, whatever, you know, kind of vehicle you use to ground yourself. To do that. That is so important. And more important to where you have the opportunity to make those changes, have those micro behaviors, like in the area and the communities and environments that you're immediately in. Because although that's happening at a macro level, I can say at a community level, people want to hold those values. People not only hold those, they believe them. We are entrenched in them and not going to let them go.
Will we see another George Floyd? Maybe if not Black American, maybe Hispanic Americans. Will we see another uprising due to some significant injustice that lights the powder keg? Will we see something erupt, do you think?
I pray that we don't. And that is my deep and solemn prayer that we don't, because that was horrific. And it was a time that, and I wasn't even living in the United States at the time when that happened. I was still living in France. And I can tell you that it reverberated across the ocean, the continents. And in my role, I was leading diversity, equity, inclusion at the time and had all the global markets. Every market felt that. I would not pray for that. But what I would pray is that, you know, there is an awakening and a veil lifted that, you know, it is not, I don't even want to say it's around diversity, equity, inclusion. I want to say that it is, you know, around this fear of, you know, that different people, gender, sexual orientation, race are, you know, able to have opportunity and able to take positions and make effective change so that this world and this country can literally be a place where everybody can thrive. And, you know, that is where there's a fear. There's a fear that, you know, when you look at the demographic census, you know, of the United States, particularly of, you know, how, you know, people of color, you know, will continue to be the growing majority if you look at the 10 to 15 years out. And that fear is driving that. 100%. And so it's masked in diversity, equity, inclusion, it's masked in, you know, xenophobia, it's masked in, you know, misogyny, all the isms that you can think of. But that is the reality. But again, you know, I don't, you know, prescribe to the fact that it is dismal and we are not without hope or not without action, because action is happening. We have federal judges and actions being taken to thwart it. But I also think, again, like I said before, it has to come for each individual really imparting change within the community and the environment that they're in, with organizations really aligning, you know, their efforts to their mission, their purpose, their kind of employee value proposition to their customer and client centricity, how they understand them. It has to get back to the roots of why were you doing this in the first place? And those organizations that did not define that or never had those strong roots to begin with, they're the ones who are backing off, because it was not solid and anchored solidly in any type of fabric of why they were doing it. And so this is where, you know, I'm purporting and really, really, really encouraging others to stand and take action.
So what disenfranchised everybody to the point where they needed to vote in this way? Because my understanding, again, from this side of the pond, is that women, people of color, Hispanic, Latino, Black communities, all voted or large enough numbers for this administration. What disenfranchised them from what was there before? There was must be some reason where people were, hang on, I want to vote for better. What was better they were expecting?
Yeah, and so I'll preface this by saying I'm not a political strategist, although I do think yeah. I understand. Yeah, and influence it. But, you know, from my perspective, and when you look at the poll numbers, it wasn't that people voted for something. I think the problem is we had a lot of people who didn't vote at all. I think that there were a lot of assumptions that I'm going to sit this one out. You know what? This will never take place. You know, this administration will never get voted in. And I'm just going to let the politics go as it where it was, because there has been too many kind of fractions back and forth. And I'm not wholly happy with, you know, the Democratic Party. I'm not wholly happy with the Republican Party, but this will never happen. So it wasn't a vote for. It was, you know, a large, which is like a third of people who just didn't show up at all. Yes. So that is the reality. And it wasn't a landslide at all. It was probably the least, I think. And again, I'm not a political strategist, but from what I've read and I've known, you know, from the debriefs of the election, was the election that, you know, this party has won by the least margin in the past, I don't know, 10, 12 elections. So it wasn't overwhelming. It was that group that just didn't come out because there was assumption that this would never happen. Kind of like what we talked about with the Handmaid's Tale. This would never happen. And oh boy, well, were we wrong.
Well, someone noticed today, actually, and their hypothesis was we were being too complacent for the rights we'd had, the life we were having. And it's now woken the world up, or certainly the Western world, to the fact that if you don't make a stand, you don't speak out, then you will get changed that you don't like. So every vote counts. Yeah.
Yes, not taking a stand and that complacency was absolutely the nail in the coffin for us. And I do think also there was just kind of genuine assumption that that can never happen in our country again. We would never regress back to the time where every person is not seen centered and feels like they can have a part of the American dream, and we are. And so it was, you know, kind of not on voting for. It's like, you know, I'm going to let the politicians and the folks through. I'm going to just sit out. And it was a shoot. It was the largest amount that we've had in many, many elections of people who just didn't show up.
Wait a minute. I'm pretty sure I'm pushing you out of your lane here a little bit into the political commentaries. Let me try and swerve you back into the comfort zone lane where you can talk about stuff. What I'd like to do is talk to our listener out there who's listening in, who's probably in HR, in DEI, EDI themselves. Maybe they're in a large company or small company. In this time where, not just in the US, it's a pushback in the anti-wokeness, the anti-DEI or EDI in the UK is being pushed back as well. People do in their businesses right now. If you're listening, this is your company. What should companies be doing at this time to either ensure their people feel a level of psychological safety, or actually keeping their business focused on what's important in the face of all this negativity?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joanne. And you know, what I think the most important thing is for organizations to really go back to their values. Why are they focusing on, and why do they value, and it is important to them, diversity, equity, inclusion, and really connected to not only what they do, but how you do it, right? And the way that you do it, how does it ensure that you are creating a psychologically safe, inclusive environment that people can be their best and bring their best? People cannot bring their best if they're in hostile environments, if they feel that they are not going to be tapped on or being able to contribute because of who they are or what their authentic selves. And how does it actually support your strategic imperatives, your business imperatives? How is it actually integrated into your purpose and your values and your mission? And if your mission is really around serving a client, a customer, or really providing a product that serves everyone, for you not to have inclusion, for you not to have a value of diversity, for you not to harness those insights and the ways of working that allows you to have culturally relevant ability to connect with the people that you serve, is going to not allow you to be successful, right? And that is what I'm encouraging organizations to get back to. In addition, I think in this environment, it is also important to have a very pragmatic and practical approach, which is really looking at, you know, your talent, your systems, right? Because what you don't want to do is actually expose yourself to kind of any retaliation or area for the government, the federal government, particularly if you have a federal contract, you will be expected to adhere to that standards, is by looking at your systems and making sure that in this environment, you don't really drive with quotas, right? You don't have a number, but you still have the processes and the systems in place to address bias, to address inequities, because at the end of the day, what you're trying to do is really make sure that you create an environment where it is meritocracy, where it is the best and the brightest, but you're not leading with a number, a quota, or, you know, any type of incentive with putting people in. And, you know, the interesting thing and the irony of it is that that is the whole intent of DEI. It's just to de-bias and open up access so that you can get the best and the brightest, because it was not allowed before, because people really just hired, tapped into, promoted people based on likeness and familiarity. And so that is what I, you know, am encouraging HR professionals, DEI professionals, and most, you know, be honest with you, CEOs and executives in these organizations to really buckle down on and focus in this time.
Yeah, because I think people misunderstood equity in all these conversations. And there's always... Also, you know, I always get a bit wild when people shove the meritocracy in my face and saying, well, the best person should get the job. Well, we know that equity is important to ensure the best person does get the job, given the fact that not everybody has the same start line.
100%. And that's what's missing from this this narrative that's being reported right now, right? And that's what the whole system was designed to do, is to give everyone the opportunity not only to start, but have continual access. Because we know that, you know, equity is challenged at every rung, from the academic, you know, through the hiring, through the development, through the promotion. So at every rung, there are biases, there are systemic processes and obstacles and barriers in place. And this is what these systems are designed to do, not to give preferential treatment or choose a particular person or background or gender, but to making sure that you have access and those, regardless of the difference, have access so the best and the brightest can shine.
Sorry, my brain just froze. I had a question ready to come out and it just disappeared. And meritocracy, equity. You're so right. One thing that I've found when I'm talking to people is that there's this perception: if you hire for diversity, you're hiring for second best. So again, this anti-equity, this pro-meritocracy argument is you must be of this demographic or you're second best. And that's the narrative that seems to be very pervasive amongst people with privilege, for want of a better way of describing it.
That is so true. I mean, it is essentially today that is the narrative that they are purporting, that it is second best, and then that you are not getting the quality of hire or the talent. When if you really dig into it, I mean, honestly, if you look at the research, you will see that those that have the diverse background are usually overeducated, overqualified, and probably have, you know, more than whatever the experience is having. But again, because they don't have the affinity, they don't have the likeness, they don't have the commonality from a pedigree or, you know, like a social economic status or, you know, an educational, they don't have access. And this is what is really, you know, kind of interesting, is because it is propaganda, right? Propaganda is like where you just kind of put a marketing and you don't have any evidence to prove it. But in fact, it's evidence against this, you know, which is the reality, which is, you know, why I think it's so important for organizations to not only tap into and leverage it, but also now create their own, you know, kind of truth telling, create their own success stories and start communicating it. Like how, when they have done it, they've been able to kind of tap into new markets. They've been able to leverage talents that, you know, were maybe not the prototype or the archetype of what they have been used to, and really talk about the benefits and the value that organizations have been able to achieve because of that. This is where you got to kind of establish your own value proposition and do some historical digging and really putting that forward and amplifying that, because that is the only way that you will challenge something that, you know, a lot of people want to believe, because to your point earlier, it will justify them rising so hard against it to protect their own privilege.
So we've seen big companies. I mean, McKinsey is a great example of one of the perpetrators, if you want, or proponent of DEI as a business imperative. You know, they make a lot of money as selling their statistics and their consulting around, you'll be X percent more this, Y percent better this, and Z percent better this if you do this, this, and this. If it was that easy, every company would be X percent better at this and Y percent better at that and Z percent better at this. But that's not happening. Are people missing the point of these initiatives, or they're not implementing them well, or do they go into them with the wrong objectives? It goes on, because we've spent billions on DEI initiatives and we're not more successful as a result. Where's the disconnect?
Well, first, I want to challenge that a bit. I don't think that there is no evidence around that. And I also want to challenge the, you know, the thought that there's billions being spent on DEI. These are not DEI. DEI is a business strategy. It is a talent program. It is accessing. And so what is being labeled and what and how you put it, it's not a DEI program with that has it on. No, these are good talent strategies. Effective employee engagement efforts. These are customer segmentation, which is a, you know, a really tried and true marketing strategy and customer centricity. These are not DEI strategy. And this is a part of the false narrative that is actually being purported, that these are just, no, these are good business practices. That's it. And like every other business practice, you have a strategy, you have imperatives, and you have actions to drive them. And like every other strategic imperative, you have people who do them well and actually are able to maximize and get the benefit of it and the value of it. And you have folks that don't do it well because they don't believe in it, or they want to keep, you know, the status quo. And I would actually go so far to say, if they do that, perhaps their growth and their ability to achieve is thwarted and is not as grown as much. So I want to make sure that when we talk about it, we don't put a label on something that is good business practices, and that, you know, those that are kind of sharing and promoting this misinformation are saying is DI. No, these are good business practices. Before there was a title or there was a label of DEI, these were still in existence, because it is known from organizational psychology and assistance approach that when people are in an environment where they feel safe, they feel included, they have the ability to be themselves, they perform the best. When you understand, you know, and have an ability to connect with your customer or client in a culturally relevant, a socioeconomic relevant, in a racial or gender that you're trying to serve them, if you do that well, you're able to understand them, connect to them, and maximize that customer experience. These are not DEI pro. These are good business strategies that now have been hijacked and have been mislabeled to purport this divisive and racist, I would go say, agenda that it is us against them. It's not. These are just good business strategies.
So if those are good business strategies, what are the toxic DEI labels that we need to shed then? What's the disconnect? What are we getting confused with?
What do you mean toxic DEI?
DEI is being labeled as toxic. It's being labeled as wasteful. What you're just saying, what I completely agree with, is that all these initiatives are sound business strategies. So what you're saying is DEI is a sound business strategy. It just happens to have got a three-letter acronym, which what we should be doing is focusing on what you're talking about here is better hiring, better well-being programs, better opportunities, better alignment with your customers, which is what we're saying. DEI is being misinterpreted as something else. And this is, we're talking about this against the meritocracy or the equity. These are the kind of words that have been branded as toxic, if you like, whereas really they're actually part of sound business practice.
Yeah. I wouldn't say they've been branded. I think they've been hijacked. And what it won't do is give those labels to those that are, again, misinforming, mislabeling, and are purporting just falsehoods. And so I'm not going to even acknowledge them as if they're not. Because at the end of the day, like you said, these are good business strategies. And when we talk about DEI, what we are actually informing is that, hey, these business strategies do allow you to have diversity, equity, inclusion. That's the outcomes. But the practices, the strategies, the efforts, the DEI, all of that is business strategies the same. You would happen to get, if when you do that well, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, there are, you know, those that we had, I mean, with missions, college mission, that you are looking intently at, you know, righting wrongs, and which we have seen through all modern societies and common societies in terms of looking at past transgressions against communities of people. We have it in Native Americans here in the United States that have, you know, received, you know, protected lands, and they have, you know, special tax practice because they were the, you know, original inhabitants of the United States. And so we have those practices. But what we're talking about, I will not acknowledge or agree that those are, you know, toxic labels. They're not. Those are labels that have been hijacked and are being misinformed. And it's not. These strategies are business strategy, effective business strategies that have been in place, by the way, for decades and decades and decades. That happen to have also a great outcome of diversity, equity, inclusion, which happens to be very sound strategies and tactics to have strong workforce, you know, of inclusion of perspective ideas, and a wonderful opportunity to understand, segment, and meet the needs of your market. Just happens to be, which is also inclusion. So I, you know, reject them and don't believe and will not say that those are toxic. It's not. It's the people that are using and hijacking them to create and push this false narrative that are using that. Everyone else, I would say most of the people understand and know that that is not the case.
I think people put too much emphasis on hiring and not enough emphasis on creating strategies for retention.
You know what? And that is, to be honest with you, that has always been, you know, quite the challenge, right? Is that you want to show the impact of your efforts by being able to bring, you know, folks of all backgrounds in so that you can truly tap into, like, you know, whole innovation, idea creation. But the reality is, and I'll say that we are feeling it here in society as well, right? In organization society, if you don't create the conditions for these individuals to feel like they can contribute, to get their ideas leveraged, to know that there's expectations for them to succeed, they won't. What will they do? They will shut down, they'll become paralyzed, and they will work in an environment that is hostile and that you're not able to tap into their best or their brightest, right? And we've seen this evident, and particularly in the United States, and been many times during the big transition. For example, after the pandemic, you know, you had a lot of women that were, you know, doing working internally, you know, at organizations, and kind of, even though they were working remotely, but they still had this huge responsibility of being caretakers for the home. And they, you know, they experienced extreme burnout. And so what happened? We saw the largest increase of female entrepreneurs after that period. Like, they just opted out of the corporate sphere and said, I'm going to go on my own because I want to be, you know, the architect of my life and really have this work-life integration as a center. You know, no such thing as balance, but integration at the center. And I think, you know, this is what is where kind of we're seeing evidence now, is that if you're not working and focused just as much on retention and the conditions that all employees can be able to contribute, then that may be the result, that not only don't tap into talent, but they may just kind of exit, choose not to kind of be a part of the corporate environment, and are going to another opportunity, another organization, or go on their own.
So let's talk to some of our listeners who are working maybe for smaller companies. I mean, you've got a lot of experience in the larger multinational, as you say, Fortune 500. And I'd like to say the maturity level of those organizations is likely to be better than the mid-size and the small and medium companies. What should CEOs of small and medium companies, CHROs, C-suite people be thinking about as their top priority? Taking the DEI label apart, going back to the sound business strategy, if you've got a kind of starting point, where should they start?
Yeah, I absolutely would recommend they start with, you know, what are the cultural conditions, you know, the organizational culture, you know, what are those behaviors that are being endorsed and communicated and upheld? And what are those behaviors that are toxic, are divisive, and that may, you know, impact you being able to really have your workforce and your talent be in a safe, welcoming, psychologically a safe environment to thrive? So looking at and focusing on the culture. And then again, really standing on how do you reinforce that and create your own narrative and your own value proposition of why you're focusing on it and what the impact it has had. What is the impact on, you know, the employee engagement, being maybe the workforce talent? What is the impact on your business? And I think by doing that, you really quell the noise outside, and it's easier to have alignment, you know, from your leaders, your managers, your HR, and for the employees to understand that I'm working in service of something greater than myself, that this organization is focusing on this, and this is the reasons why I'm expected to behave, to work, to interact, to have those connections with my colleagues and also to our customer and clients. By doing that, it really allows the outside to be silenced, and that everyone knows when they walk through those doors, regardless of what's happening in society, that this is the expectation set for them.
I hear a lot of people on LinkedIn, you know, it's quite a common topic of DEI / HR burnout, where people are getting really frustrated. And I mean, we talked about the current world climate or the current US-centric climate at the moment being very, very anti-DEI, whatever it may be. How can people in those positions keep on keeping on, if you like, in the face of negativity, rejection. If you're a person of color, you're black, a black woman trying to advocate for these roles, and there's this pervasiveness in society saying this is all wrong. It must be quite tough psychologically at the moment to keep going, mustn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think that there's a lot of people from the mountains joining anti-DEI, but I've seen so many that have stood up and really championed and say that we're not here, not today. I mean, even you're across the pond in Germany, I was really happy to hear, you know, when J.D. Vance went to speak and really tried to purport, you know, the, and I forgot the name of the political party, but the Chancellor of Germany said, we're not going backward. That made me feel pride. And that's what we need to be talking about when we talk about the anti-DEI. And then also those that are expressly and deliberately not embracing that. And there we are seeing that quite significantly. I mean, we saw Emmanuel Macron as well kind of stand up and say, you know, this is really interesting, crazy things happening over there, but we're going to kind of double down here. But the burnout is real. And the burnout is one that I would say is coming because you have the HR practitioners. You have those who, you know, still work or continue to work in DEI, as well as, you know, just the everyday managers. I don't want to take them out because they are the curators of the culture and the work environment for employees to work in. There's burnout there. And it's because, you know, you have like this multifaceted challenge that you have to kind of manage. You know, how do you keep your employees engaged and keep them motivated, as well as understand that there's different attitudes, beliefs that are pervasive in the workplace because they come from society, right? And how do you make sure that you're aligning yourself so you can bring the best and actually have the conditions so people can feel like that they can contribute and thrive? And one of the things that, you know, I say it is so important is around giving the space to do that coaching, that advisory to your leaders right now. You know, really, that is so important because the leaders need to make meaning for themselves and be able to sit with whatever their personal opinions, their affiliation is outside, but what is needed inside the organization and why. And I think that executive counsel and coaching, if you will, is so imperative right now because that connection in terms of what impact it has on the culture, the work, the pulse of the organization, the ability for your organization to continue to be productive, aligned, still have, you know, the spirit and energy to drive performance, or to get stuck in this, you know, cycle of reactionary responses that produce, you know, no good or no impact. And so, you know, my recommendation during this time is really to kind of work with your leaders doing the counsel advisory and also at the same time creating spaces for your employees to share and to, you know, really acknowledge what they are experiencing, what they're going through, and what is really happening, you know, within the walls of their companies so that they can address those things from a micro level and a macro level. And, you know, it is a tough time. So I'm not going to mask it and say that it's going to be easy. But I think doing those two things, you could at least understand the pulse and get an understanding of the pulse of what's happening. But then also, you know, really walk with and sit with your leaders to help shepherd them because they have just as much challenge and work to do to not only make meaning, but to show up in a way that'll allow their organizations to continue to perform and not be paralyzed or spin during this crazy moment that we're in.
The moment that we're in. I love that as a soundbite. How long's a moment? This will probably be the longest moment ever. It's, but I suppose in terms of the Earth's history, this is just a microsecond in the billions of years we've been going on. I'm sure it'll just be in the billions of years to come, it will just be insignificant. So I hope you're right. I hope we look back at this and laugh about, do you remember that crazy time in 2025? And when the world had a bit of a reset. But then I suppose we survived COVID. You know, the world, we never predicted that a global pandemic could wipe us out in the way it did, and we'd react in the way we did, and things would change so much. Maybe this is just another pandemic. It's just man-made.
It's not the world. I want to make sure that we're clear. This is not the world.
It's not the world.
These are, you know, I purport them to, you know, people with pots and pans that are just, you know, making noise. But they're doing that is not the world. I think that, you know, we have just as much or maybe even more, you know, folks, you know, here in the United States and across the world that don't want to go back to those times and that are doing amazing work to make sure that they stand on their values, they stand on the opportunities and, you know, the benefits that is gained. So I think we all should embrace that. And again, start with those micro behaviors that you can do in your own environment, right? In your own community, because that's where change is really made.
Yeah, just doubling down on what you're saying earlier, this is sound business sense we're talking here. We're talking about sound business sense.
Yes.
Aligning with customers, showing your colleagues, your staff, your people around you feel a sense of belonging, sense of inclusion, discretionary effort, all the things we know happen when people are feeling the magic. Tapping into wide talent pools through our hiring strategies. We're picking from a global market now, online resources, everything. We're truly finding the best people and making sure we give them the tools in order to be heard and seen and have that voice. That's all we're talking about here, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all. Let's, you know what? We can just get rid of the label or like have a label. Because this is just good business strategies. And those that are working, you know, and I would like to say like the Jamie Dimons of the world, we have so many CEOs are stepping up and basically saying the same thing, are not letting the rhetoric stop them or put fear in them. And that's what we need to stand behind and emulate.
Emma, I've loved this conversation. It's been absolutely fascinating. How can people get hold of you? Because you've got so much to say and it's fascinating, even when I pushed you out of your lane a little bit. So how can people get hold of you?
Well, thank you, Joanne. This has been such an engaging discussion and quite thought-provoking. So you can get in contact with me. I'm at www.waymohoover.com. And once you go in there, you can actually just go www.belimitlesscom.com is my business consulting strategy where you can get to and access through waymohoover.com as well. I'm on LinkedIn. And so I also have a lot of articles that I have written for various publications. You can check out my article and position on many of these topics as well. And on Instagram, I'm Wayma Hoover. And I look forward to not only continuing this dialogue, but Joanne, I look forward to seeing what you do. I think that the work that you're leading is so important. And these open, honest dialogue is really what help people learn. I think we got to get in these days, we have to get away from the corporate speak and get to really the essence of how people are thinking, feeling, and what they can do, like what's in there. So I thank you for all you do.
Wayma, thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.